My name's Daniel Cotter. I lived and worked in Russia for 10 years. Because of that, I'm well aware of the secrecy, the red tape, and the fear surrounding the Stalin period. He may have been one of the most notorious leaders of the 20th century, but getting at the man behind the monster was almost impossible for decades. Joseph Stalin was very good at concealing inconvenient and even horrifying truths. Not anymore, however, because Yale University have put Stalin's private papers online, all 400,000 of them. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is Digitizing Stalin. Alright, so we're standing here in Brooklyn, New York, and you might wonder what we're doing here in a program about Stalin and his archive in the Soviet Union. And the reason for that is because we're in a part of Brooklyn called Little Odessa, and that's where in the 1970s the first major wave of Soviet emigration to the US landed here, and they kind of built a micro-Soviet Union on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean. But the thing to remember about Stalin is that his impact was truly global. Although we think of him as a Soviet dictator, his reach was across just huge stretches of land and across countries, and people were forced to live under regimes modeled on his, to read his books. And to some degree, I mean, the echoes of what he did are felt today.
Can I ask you some questions in English?
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
My English is so, like, much better than your Russian.
Maybe not.
I hope.
So you're from Odessa?
Yes, I am from Odessa. Odessa, Ukraine.
Do you remember, was it like Khrushchev when you were young?
Of course. Well, it was terrible time.
Uh-huh.
We have the card, one bread.
Uh-huh.
For 5 days.
Wow.
For all family.
And when you were little, did people ever talk about Stalin, or did they never talk about Stalin?
Of course. I don't want to remember this. Uh-huh. It's everything is true what you read now.
So if, for example, right now, you know, Yale University, because they have put Stalin's archive on the internet. So if
I don't have an internet.
Okay.
You know?
If you walk around Little Odessa, you'll often see clusters of old gentlemen and old ladies sitting outside their apartment buildings, shooting the breeze and taking in the sights. And I spotted one interesting character who was sitting there with a sailor's cap on his head and a very jovial expression. So I went over to strike up a conversation.
Помню Сталин. Все плакали. Хотя писали, что кто-то не верит. Но при нем было...
We were just coming away from speaking to Oleg, who was sitting there in a sailor's cap. He came here 25 years ago. He's 70 years old now. We were just talking about his life here, and he says, you know, America's great. When he was living in the Soviet Union, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. That was when he told me his father had died. He was fighting as a partisan in World War II. And when he was 3 years old, his father died. And then he showed me his card of the Holocaust survivors of the Soviet Union. And then he introduced us to Леонид.
Леонид, он хочет спросить, как было при Сталине? При Сталине тебе было хорошо?
He was 88 years old, and he had fought in Stalin's army for 8 years.
8 лет.
Он будет писать,
инвалид войны. 8 лет.
And he was almost 30 when Stalin died. He kind of lived through all of that trauma. He said America was golden. Here he could live free and there was no persecution. So for him it was a wonderful place.
It's a situation after a revolution, the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. Things can quiet down, which is what in the West people were hoping in the 20s, or alternatively they cannot.
Professor Sheila Fitzpatrick is a historian of the Soviet period, with a particular fascination for everyday life under Stalin.
Stalin is the person who comes in 7 years after the revolution, after Lenin's death, and instead of quietening down a return to normalcy, he pushes the revolution further. That's with the collectivization of agriculture, the forced industrialization plan of the beginning of the 30s. It's a time, therefore, of tremendous upheaval. From the revolution to the Second World War, then that's more upheaval. Soviet Union emerges from the Second World War not as a pariah nation, as it had been since the revolution, but as one of two superpowers. So that's a very major change of status.
From this point, Stalin became the monster we know today, an image that perhaps overpowers any efforts we might make to conceive of him as a man. There are estimates of as many as 20 million dead under his rule. Stories of forced famine, the horrors of collectivization, peasants displaced, killed and starved, the purges, the knock on the door in the night, show trials, even family members, Stalin's own family members, were not safe from his vengeful eye, his paranoia. And then there is the cult of personality, the monuments, the statues, the movies, the posters. Depending on your perspective, he was a monster of evil or a super genius of communism. But it's hard to see the man. And this is why it's so exhilarating to be able to access his personal papers anywhere in the world, thanks to the digitization of his archive.
This station is New Haven.
Last stop, New Haven, everybody rise and shine.
Sits, but he moved offices. He moved from the second floor to a different office, and I think at that
time we're in the offices of Yale University Press, waiting to meet Vadim Staklo, who is the mastermind behind the Stalin Digital Archive.
And fittingly enough, given the subject matter, his office was hidden away deep underground.
When the Soviet Union collapsed and Yeltsin came to power, what happened was what we call is the archival revolution, because one of the first decrees that Yeltsin issued was to open up all the archives. Everybody rushed there because the feeling was that now we will find all those smoking guns. Of course, it's not as easy, but nevertheless, the opportunity was there. And the then editorial director of the press, Jonathan Brent, he basically went to Moscow and started talking to people, asking, you know, what can be done? What can we do as publishers?
Well, a lot, as it turned out. The first fruits of this collaboration was the series Annals of Communism, which included books on everything from The Secret World of American Communism to Piggy Foxy and the Sword of Revolution, a collection of the doodles that members of the Politburo drew of each other during these interminable meetings that they all had to sit through.
Here, for example,
there's a kind of caricature by Mezhlauk of N.P. Bruchanov, and it says, People's Commissar of Finances of the USSR at the second day of trial. And there's a note by Stalin attached. To the members of the Politburo, for all the sins past and present, hang Bruchanov by the balls. If the balls hold out, consider him acquitted by trial. If they do not, drown him in the river. Joseph Stalin.
And you probably know that Stalin, he was a student at some point of a theological seminary. Mm-hmm. So he probably knew those methods of witch hunt.
And then at the turn of the millennium, Stalin's papers were at long last declassified. And the director of the archive in Moscow called Yale with a radical suggestion.
So he said, well, why don't we just try to digitize the whole thing? The entire archive is approximately 28,000 documents, and that's slightly under maybe 400,000 pages. As of today, the bulk of those documents are scanned, and we are very close to finishing.
Times have certainly changed since Sheila Fitzpatrick first attempted to access a Soviet archive in the 1960s.
The first thing I had to do was get myself to Moscow. Then I had a big battle to get into the archives, not the ones we're going to be talking about today, because they were in the Central Party archives, the Holy of Holies, but state archives anyway. I arrived there at the end of 1966, and he died in 1953. And it was even closer to the Khrushchev period, to the thaw, which had been a very exciting time. I came when that excitement had been to some degree disappointed, but it was still around.
I lived in Russia for 10 years, not far from Vadim, although we never met. And in all that time, I hadn't even tried to borrow a book from the National Library out of a fear of its mind-blowing bureaucracy. So to think that now I could access Stalin's private papers through the internet just with the click of a button was an opportunity too good to miss.
Let's just enter Hitler and see what it gives us. This is exactly what we were talking about. It's a telegram from Hitler to Stalin. He congratulates him on signing the German-Soviet
trade agreement. And he's also saying that the non-aggression pact means for me the fortification of the German policy for a long term. The Germany this way returns to the political line which has been useful for hundreds of years to both of our states.
And so suddenly you can see this very brief note between two of history's great monsters. It's a very simple letter, but even though you can't touch it, it does feel like you're much closer to the document and thus to the time and to the people.
And of course, being able to see the documents, not just in translation, not just in transcription, but in color, makes a huge difference, because there was a difference between a blue pencil and a red pencil. There is a difference between the tone of the paper, and you can tell, for example, whether pages were added later just by the way they look. You can see a couple of spots on those pages, and you just start thinking, well, what was it? Maybe his teacup, or maybe his pipe, you know, that burnt a circle there. Even if it's neither, you know, it still gives you some kind of tactile ability, you know, to interact with the original document.
When you first started looking at the archive yourself, what were some of the surprising things that you found?
I think probably the thing that struck me most was he really was trying to control every major aspect of social, political, and cultural life. When editing the short course of the history of the Communist Party, the authors of the original manuscript, they would always write the great Comrade Stalin, you know, thanks to his greatness and wisdom, etc., and so on and so forth. He would strike that all out. And he would present himself as a mere modest agent of a huge historical process.
Now, I don't want to say that retaining power was not a very important thing to him. He was vigilant against any threat. But he's after pushing the revolution further. If you only wanted to stay in power, I don't think collectivization would be the way to go. That was a very risky policy.
The gulf between the utopian dream and the level of butchery is kind of hard to process. And so when I looked at the archive, I was looking for some kind of moment when Stalin let the mask slip. My impression was that, yes, he did believe. I couldn't find overt signs of bad faith.
I think you're right. He probably believed in what he was doing. He probably believed in the harsh measures that had to be taken. He probably didn't see any other way also.
Stalin's aim is radical transformation. And he assumed that violence is necessary. The peasants are the first victims, but it moves on. In the great purges, you have also the elites are victims. So the death lists, that are the list of names of people to be arrested as enemies of the people, many of whom were killed, he checks them off, as do the other members of the team. And for us, that is an awful thing. It's not quite clear that he saw it in that light. I don't see any signs of him thinking, oh my God, I've been on the wrong path all this time. I think no, on the contrary, I think he's fairly pleased with what he'd done.
These actions are hard for people in liberal democracies to understand. Stalin methodically ticking off names in his death lists. This was a man completely committed to his vision from the outset.
Looking at material in the purges, the great purges of the late 30s, near the beginning, local people are not quite sure they've got the message right, and they're writing in and say, well, we seem to have a lot of enemies of the people out here in Vologda or wherever it is. Should we arrest them or some of them or whatever? And Stalin writes back with great firmness, absolutely. We certainly knew before his deep involvement in the purges, but somehow that drove it home to me, that particular thing.
I'm Daniel Calder, and you're listening to Digitizing Stalin on BBC World Service, the remarkable story of how Joseph Stalin's most private papers were digitized and made available online.
Something that struck me is the sense of being injected into these events as they happened in real time, and the gap between our perspective, we know everything that happened afterward, and they don't know how things are going to unfold, and so there's this kind of tension between our knowledge and their lack of knowledge.
Well, I guess you're talking about seeing the human side of a monster, and then that makes the banality of evil even more terrible, right? But there were politicians, they were humans, they were people who were trying to do something great. So for them, that's what defined their lives, not the millions of people who were killed. For us, that's what defines them, because that's what we learn from history books. For them, they saw quite a different selves in the mirror.
Another thing that struck me, this is on completely other tack, was that among the letters Stalin received, this is in the 20s, the mid-20s, he gets a letter from a young communist out in the provinces somewhere, and this person says, I would like to take your name, the name of Stalin, because I admire you and because you're Lenin's great disciple and so on. Now, normally you would expect Stalin would ignore such a letter, but for some reason he answered it and he said, yes, that's fine, I would like that, you could be a younger brother to me, I never had a younger brother. I think the monster is also part of the man.
I'm Matvey Yankelevich. I'm a writer, a translator, and a publisher. I am originally from Moscow. I grew up in the States. My family came in the late 70s. They were sort of kicked out of Russia for dissident activities.
That's because Matvey's grandmother was Yelena Bonner, the famous dissident, and his step-grandfather was Andrei Sakharov, Nobel Peace Prize winner, physicist and dissident. So he had personal reasons for wanting to explore the archive.
I was reading, or probably 1930 or so, a pretty mundane letter that had to do with grain production and markets and the import of American grain, the export of Russian grain, and I think it was to Molotov. And the details were really surprising, the percentages, the specifics about the grain. But also, at the end, there's a bit about personnel, who needs to be arrested, who needs to be gotten rid of. And the language around that is so unusual for formal correspondence. It really is like criminal language. It's really like underworld language to some degree, but also the language of someone who's extremely sensitive. Like, you know, he gets angry about someone's insolence. He calls someone a shyster and therefore has to get arrested, you know, this kind of thing. So he's extremely interested in the details of personnel, obviously, like a human resources guy. He really knew who to work with, how to get people to work on things in his interests.
The criminal language that Matvey noticed scribbled in the margins was not unusual for Stalin. Nothing escaped his critical eye. There are many more telling examples of Stalin's marginalia in the archive.
Like, for example, reading books by Karl Kautsky, one of his political nemesis, if you want. He would occasionally write scum, you know, or an idiot, or a traitor, meaning traitor to the cause of the working class. And then all of a sudden, you know, you would see on the margins like a relatively lengthy theoretical discussion of certain issues. So looks like marginal notes, he did it not for the public, but for himself. And that's probably the closest as we can get to his thinking.
Stalin was a dedicated editor of other people's work. And that means not just editing for ideology, which is what we would have assumed, that he went through and sort of cut things out that he didn't think were quite the party line, but he edited for grammar, for punctuation, for paragraphing, and he was a good editor, professional standard, I would say.
The speed of the writing is really interesting. I mean, from a writer's point of view, to look at the handwritten scans, it's actually extremely steady. It's not the handwriting of someone who's psychologically unstable. It's very clear, swift, direct.
Stalin was very busy running the Soviet Union, but he was like perhaps the supreme micromanager of all time.
I think Stalin understood very well, maybe more than many of his comrades, the value of printed matter and the value of cinema, the value of radio, and the value of visual art. Stalin was an image. He was not just an image of himself, but he was an image of a country.
And here is one of the remarkable things about the digital nature of the archive. You can be with Stalin in his office 1 minute as he signs death lists, checking off the names,
And the next minute you can leap forward to later in the evening as he's unwinding with friends at one of his legendary movie nights.
Okay, so here we go.
We have a yellowed document, which is a transcription of a conversation Stalin had about what movie he was going to watch that night. Present comrades Molotov, Voroshilov, Kaganovich, Zhdanov, Orjonikidze, Postyshev, and Yanukidze. So, stupendous, we know who's there, who's sitting in the room with them. And these guys were all very, very high ranking. Basically, they were the top of the Soviet Union. Stalin at the meeting asked how things were going and what we were going to watch. Voroshilov says, oh, there are truly magnificent films about the Donbass in the Ukraine, the uprising of man. Stalin replies, don't produce any more crap like Accordion. I can't promise that all the movies produced are going to be good. There could be one or two among them that are rejects, but I don't think Accordion's crap. It's just an average film by a young, promising producer. And this is interesting because you see one of Stalin's lackeys is disagreeing with him. He's saying, this isn't a crap film. This film's okay. And so Voroshilov says, don't beat around the bush. It's a lousy movie where the accordion is transformed into nearly the main lever of class struggle. And Kaganovich says, yes, it's crap and incredibly tasteless. So here you have these guys who are like just criticizing this work of propaganda. It's too crude even for them. So they watched this movie, Churyushkin. She says they received it well. And then Stalin gave some suggestions, some corrections, and asked how the film was selling abroad. So it's also, as much as they're discussing this movie, there's very, you know, detailed discussions of the state of Soviet film production, the state of how they work for propaganda purposes. So it's kind of going back and forth between Stalin as the viewer, but also Stalin thinking critically about how this can be used. Who is it? Shh, he's not even listed. B.S.H.
That's Boris Shumetsky.
Okay. We'll just find out who this guy who's not named is.
He was in charge of the movie industry.
Okay, so this is a discussion with Boris Shumetsky, who was in charge of the movie industry from 1933. And he didn't know it at the time, but he was going to be shot in 1938. So Stalin is having a friendly conversation. Some guy is going to help, who he would subsequently, you know, kill. So we throw the archive open. Anybody can go in there. Anybody can now draw their own conclusions. People without training, without context. Is there a danger?
I think a greater danger is to have those documents available just to a small pool of professional historians. I think the more people can see it, the more people can make their own conclusions, whether good or bad, it doesn't matter. The more open and accessible these materials are, the better for our general understanding of our own past.
But they're not entirely accessible. Although I would love to imagine a world in which any one of us could rummage through Stalin's metaphorical underwear drawer, sending the old monster spinning in his grave, here, from this final indignity, Stalin has been spared by his arch-nemesis, capitalism.
The way access is organized is that Yale University Press has the worldwide distribution rights, except for Russia and Belarus. So Yale sells access to pretty much, you know, any institution that might be interested in it, library, university, scholarly center. But in Russia, Rosarchiv, which is the federal agency in charge of the Russian archives, they have their own website onto which they have uploaded the Stalin papers. And access in Russia is free.
Is there any Stalin material that is yet to be declassified, or does this digital archive contain everything?
The digital archive contains everything that is available.
There are materials, of course, that have not been declassified yet. For example, what I know is the correspondence between Stalin and Yezhov, who was head of the secret police during the Great Terror years. It's still kept in the presidential archive. I think most likely the reason to retain certain documents as classified, it's more of a bureaucratic inertia rather than any particular political reason. Although there might be some, but let's ask ourselves, what kind of awful things we could possibly find in the archive that have not been already either published or thought about? Okay? I mean, Stalin has been both glorified and demonized to the maximum extent possible. So in our perception, no matter what we find, he probably won't look much better or much worse.
A project like this, which shows us them in these private moments, unedited and unguarded, it really knocks them off their pedestals, whether a pedestal of glory or a pedestal of evil. It just, it kind of dethrones them.
You can call it dethroning, we can call it humanizing. It's fun, one way or another.
And that's not a word you normally associate with the history of totalitarianism.
Well, we live in this time when we have this great privilege of not being afraid of accessing these materials and discussing them openly. And I think we really should appreciate that.